Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the donation of Constantine. This is actually a document ceding the papal states to the Roman Church, and it's a document which appeared in the around from the 4th century. It was written in the 4th, apparently written in the 4th century, rediscovered in the 8th century, just in the nick of time, and in the 15th century. Scholars proved that it was a fake. Now, why am I doing something on it? It's a very important document. It's a bit like the weapons of mass destruction, which got us into the Iraq War, or various things which at the time seems provocation or necessary documentation for history to proceed down a particular track. And the particular track is the separation between the Eastern and Western Orthodox churches and the actual setting up of the papal state. So it's a foundation document. And the actual process of it going through is very important. So, let's talk about what Constantine. Constantine was a Roman emperor, and I think the empire was united by him, and he set up five centres of the church, one at Constantinople, is modern Istanbul, one, I think, Antioch, Jerusalem, Rome, I think there's another one in there. There were five at least. And there were five equal churches, and they would come together and have a council. And so there was no one particular head, no one perhaps dominated more than any other, except the one at Constantinople had the emperor with it, and the other parts of the Roman Empire would call out for assistance. There's also I suppose we call the fall of the Roman Empire, the second half of the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, died when finally Constantinople fell. In the 15th century, there was still Constantinople. It hadn't fallen yet. There was various crusades to it and all various things like that. Definitely back in the 8th century, its power was waning, and idea of sort of independent autonomy sort of went a different direction. It's an idea to have strength, but its strength is beginning to think for itself. So there were different forces at play affecting Rome and the Roman Church, their centre of the church there, in the 8th century. So you had the problems of the Muslim invasions up through the Mediterranean. I think the Muslims had actually taken Sicily, just off the top of my head. They'd taken Spain. There was a lot of threats there. Then there was various threats to the church. There's the Lombards. It's hard to say. I have never read a good story about the Lombards, and it's interesting that when I visited Andorra, a little principality in the Pyrenees between France and Spain, that they have this Lombardian architecture. So it's not quite Renaissance, it's not quite classical, it's in between the two. But there were all these forces, and in order to provoke Pepin, the grandfather of Charlemagne, to come down and actually assist the church, they said, "Hey, look, we've got this document that Constantine has actually given us the land." So Constantine had actually converted the church into actually a political state. So there was this document which did there, and Pepin, who is a Christian, has a belief in Christianity. And you have to remember, at the 8th century, there were still Saxons and there were still missionaries. One of the places is that places with well-organized heathenism, Saxons and those Druids and other people like that. That didn't succeed, but it succeeded like a bonfire in Britain. And so Britain there's Rome, and Britain was a real missionary field, and a lot of British Christian missionaries came down and went through Europe. So Britain was very important in this time. There was a relationship between the Teutonic people. I think there was, I've forgotten its first name, something the Hammer. It was a particularly vicious or strong leader called something or other the Hammer, and he came down and hammered the invading Muslims who were coming up through Spain across the Pyrenees. It's historically whether this was a major invasion or just raiding party, which was stopped by a larger force of well-organized Teutonic knights, of Middle Ages knights. These are real Middle Ages times. It stopped it, and this calling in the Teutonic knights had always been the process that sort of developed. It had morphed into developing the actual structure of church and society and schools as we know it. So what would happen is that the Roman or civilized people would have the Roman family and the slaves, and then the raiders would come in, live rudely off the land, and the economy would collapse. They'd run out of food, and the people who lived on the hills in their houses with the old Roman houses. So the Roman houses are basically a Roman house has a cloister, and so there was an evolution of Christianity being shoveled into the Roman culture. So Christianity got pushed into the Roman culture, and today you still have Christianity or many organizations where there's the management and the workers. You've got the abbots, and then you've got the lower friars. There's sort of a double-stranded view into it. So into this entire process, they pulled out a relic. Now, of course, a lot of the relics at this time were specious, and it's quite entertaining to read various. There's also the stories of the true cross, why is there a true cross? Also, so many fake crosses around the place, and I can't really remember the mechanism. I think there was a wife of Constantine. I think it was wife of Constantine went to Jerusalem, and there were all these cross merchants going along selling crosses, and so she was ushered into this place, and there were three crosses there. Okay, that makes sense, because there were three. We know there's three crosses. These are the original three crosses. Which one works? And so she hurt herself or got someone to heal with that cross and identified that as the true cross, and so the true cross was taken. So all this world was full of reliquary and mysticism. Now, it's if you read back into the history and read some of the tales, there is this mystic view, and the actual standard of proof wasn't very high, and so people, if they wanted to win an argument, could bring out this relic. And so the donation of Constantine is the actual creation of the papal states, and it was found at the 8th century just in time to get Pepin the Great, and then later on Charlemagne was a bit more wily, and he came in and for his protection he said, well, you have to make me emperor. So it founded this foundation document of the Holy Roman Empire, sort of, and definitely the foundation document of the Roman Church. And so it's very interesting at the time in the 15th century, around 1450-ish or 1430-ish, around that time, when it was studied in a method, the actual studying method of scholasticism. So there are different methods. So it's a medieval method of scholasticism, which is it's hard to say, going through things line by line, checking everything. There was a conclusion that because of I think it's because of the languages used. It was written in the wrong language, because I think the language of the church was Greek and it was written in Latin, something very obvious to us now. But there was quite a lot of detailed detective work done by this person called Nicholas de Cusa. If I would say anything, is a paradigm shifting discovery. It's sort of like an American discovering that the not the moon landing was faked, but the entire American War of Independence was faked. It would be a shifting thing, and then you'd have to get back to a society which works and have a different perspective, and you'd see that the system of scholasticism, which is basically things were valid because they were had the name, the word true stamped on it, and so that led to one document true. Well, let's redefine the way I think. That's what the way scholasticism across did. So really, it's very interesting to look at Nicholas de Cusa, and it's Cusanus, Nicholas Cusanus. That's the more Latinized name of it. It's really interesting to look at that because this is a powerful thing. It's not a, I don't he doesn't write about it as directly confrontational, but it would shake the way that he came in across it. So as he comes in from a different school of scholarship, and comes in with a different technique, he has a lot of very interesting ideas which are proto-scientific ideas. So it's sort of like the Donation of Constantine is the spark which unraveled the method of medieval thinking, which led to the Renaissance and Enlightenment. That's the way I read it. So I think the Donation of Constantine is a very important document, and on that, when I next come and get a little bit of time for research, I'll try and research a bit more in detail. But I hadn't been really interested in arguing or talking to anyone about it. It's something which, if that document by subtraction is like the basic fault analysis, it's rather than trying to come up with a theory, you just simply ask the question, how did we arrive at this situation? And there's many parallel paths, and if this wasn't here, what would have happened? And that process happened. What are some of the cause analysis? So this is rather than the actual theory analysis, hypothesis analysis, and fitting it in. It's just localized cause analysis. And in localized cause analysis, the Donation of Constantine, which is a forged document, known to be by the church to be forged, yet somehow it was able to morph over it. And it's very interesting then that you see in the 15th century, Constantine, not Constantine, in the 15th century, Nicholas de Cusa having this realization in the background. It's not something that he stood up, but this influence meant that he was seeing the union of the Eastern and Western orthodoxies, the schisms. But he was also looking at the unification of Islam and Christianity. And this is a concept which we find nowadays is bizarre, yet we are still following down documents. We have our own documents or beliefs floating around which are faked or manufactured for us, like the Donation of Constantine. It's very interesting that you can go out and build an army, win a war, burn a village or something like that, or you can be a monk with a very fertile mind and produce a document, and that will be on par with these great m known military minds. There's these unknown movers in history which we can't see, and really form things up. And I think people who have show me, tell me the story, tell me the person, tell me the narrative. And then if it's not conforming to that, they let it go. So this is a non-narrative, factual, analytical thing. It's a document. It's an artifact. It is truly an artifact. It's an artifact which is actually not part of genuine history, if there was any form of genuine history. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'll get into podcasting about Nicholas de Cusa. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.